Now, I know some of you from way back, and some of you I've just met, so I thought I'd introduce myself a little bit and level the playing field. I grew up near Burien, Washington. I met Jack at MIT, and at the end of my junior year, we got married in Boston. After we finished a couple of degrees at MIT, we moved to Tacoma, Washington, and came to this church. I worked for Boeing at the time, got to travel to a lot of European countries, worked a fair amount for the Greek airline. We then moved to England for Jack to do his PhD, and I worked for, that's the street we lived on, the second house on the left there, that was the one you visited us, yep. And Mike and Barbara Simpson visited us there, and Steve O'Bannon visited us there, and I'm trying to remember. Sandy, but I'm trying to think, did anybody else visit us there? I know Sandy did, because she even came in with me to work that one day. Anyway, it was fun there. We then returned to the U.S. in 1989, and Jack was ordained in the PCA for us to plant a church in Spokane, Washington. That's where our daughter Joy was born. Then 25 years ago, we moved to St. Louis for Jack to teach at Covenant Seminary. And that is where our, there's Covenant Seminary. And that's where Joseph was born. Now, when you teach at the same place for 25 years, it kind of grows on you. That's where we raised our family, in St. Louis, with frequent vacations back to Washington State. Now, the reason that you see me so frequently at Faith Pres Tacoma is that I come out a number of times a year, usually, to visit my mom, who lives up in Kirkland. I am very pleased to be with you all today. Thank you, Dawn, and whoever else you had to get permission from to invite me to speak with you. But I'm very happy to be here. Now, I don't have a lot of slides, for there are a few, but you'll be seeing that most of the time because I'll just be speaking. The reason I chose to speak on sorrow and love is because that's what the Lord has been guiding me through at this time in my life, and also because Francis Schaeffer encourages us to always speak about truth and reality. I'm taking a class with Jaron Bars. He's teaching on Francis Schaeffer right now. And Christianity tells us the truth about us, about life, about what we face. And if we don't acknowledge suffering and sorrow in this life, our conversation becomes irrelevant. Suffering is real, and we should weep over it. The culture around us is pretty frank about it, and I have that on good authority. Life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says differently is selling something. I don't know why I was surprised when great sorrow entered my life. Perhaps I didn't expect sorrow to be ongoing. I thought sorrow would be just for a time, and not a very long time. Instead, sorrow and grief came and stayed. I'm choosing today not to describe my particular sorrow, but perhaps that's best, since we can identify with one another in the experience of sorrow and suffering, even though our particular life stories are different. We may experience sorrow that comes from causes that might be relational, bodily, mental, emotional, spiritual, or combinations of those. The causes may be different, but each one of us experiences it. I'd like to tell you about the journey God has me on and what I've learned so far about sorrow and love. We began with that hymn on purpose. It has become deeply meaningful to me. If you think about the words, our souls are wounded and weary. Many times we are bowed low with sorrow, And yet, God is always loving toward us. The writer of Lamentations tells us of God's love, and he can't seem to find sufficient words to express how faithful and strong and eternal that love is. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. Job seems to have that same understanding and expresses it in the midst of his suffering. Though he slay me, I will hope in him. God knows that we suffer in this world. In the Old Testament, we see one of his provisions. When Solomon built the temple, God was present with his people in an especially powerful way. We can tell from Solomon's prayer in dedicating the temple, one of the reasons God planned for this to be a place where his people would come together. Solomon asks, "Will God indeed dwell with man on earth?" And then lists many, many burdens that God's people will bring to the temple, and the Lord will hear and answer. One is in chapter 6, verse 29 of 2 Chronicles. "Whatever prayer, whatever plea is made by any man or by all your people Israel, each knowing his own affliction and his own sorrow, and stretching out his hands toward this house, then hear from heaven." Our experience of sorrow and suffering is not incompatible with true belief in God. Believers experience sorrow. In Psalm 31, "My life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing." The Apostle Paul was cut to the heart by the unbelief of his Jewish kinsmen. In Romans 9, "I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart." Consider Psalm 88, one of the bleakest psalms of lament. It begins in lament and it stays in lament to the very end. "O Lord, God of my salvation," this is a believer, "I cry out day and night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry, for my soul is full of troubles. My eye grows dim through sorrow." To help us understand the significance of this psalm, I'd like to quote the wise and illustrious author of the ESV Study Bible Notes for the Book of Psalms. Since Psalm 88 is in the canonical psalms, the faith of this psalm cannot be separated from the faith expressed in the rest of the book, and it helps its singers to see that faith can be real, even when it cannot arrive at strong hope after prayer. Even a man who had no sin was known as a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, who has borne our grief and carried our sorrows. In God, we see the intertwining of sorrow and love. When Jesus walked on the earth, he didn't just identify with our sorrows. He experienced deep sorrow. In Matthew 23, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not." And Luke explains, "When he drew near to Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it." He had all the power needed to change things, but he endured sorrow. And how does he respond? respond to it? With love. The Lord is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. Matthew describes Jesus seeking the companionship of his dearest friends. Taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even unto death. Remain here and watch with me." Luke continues, "And he withdrew and knelt down and prayed. And there appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly." Note that the angel strengthened him, but that did not take away his agony. The whole of Romans 5, in that chapter, Paul teaches us that that God loved us while we were still causing him great sorrow. Do we see this in ourselves as we live our lives in community with one another? In our home church, we have a couple of different people who have suffered through great sin, church discipline, repentance, and restoration. These individuals were under no compulsion to stay in our church for the long term. After being restored, it might have been easier for them to transfer to another church where they could make a fresh start and in some ways erase the past. But they stayed in our church. And each of them is a living reminder of the reality and the thoroughness of forgiveness. They are restored. My point is not that this should be the specific path for every case. My point is that these individuals could sense that they were not hypocritically judged by the members of the church. This love for our brethren is a testimony to others that we are a body of redeemed sinners, loved by God. I do want to make a qualification here. Forgiveness doesn't necessarily mean that everything is back to the way it was. We have to be wise about relationships, especially abusive relationships. Abusive relationships can be dangerous in many ways, and we as a church are called to protect the vulnerable. I have walked with more than one person through the trauma of recognizing and leaving an abusive relationship. It would have been wrong for those believers to stay in those particular situations with continued risk to themselves and their children. Abuse victims need us, and we as their church family need to provide love, godly counsel, help, and safety. But thinking back to difficult relationships in general, our interactions with others need to spring from love. And our love needs to be wise. Boundaries are often appropriate, but they need to be guided by wise love. We do not have a right to a trouble-free, happy life. That should not be our aim. Our aim is to love God and to love one another. Back in 2015, I was struggling. The sorrow and grief were great. Sometimes my praying would dissolve into weeping, and God seemed to be silent. That summer, we had to be in Cambridge, England for ESV Bible meetings. Dr. J.I. Packer would be there too, and I so wanted him to answer my private questions. But it seemed there were always loads of people around him. Friends of ours in Cambridge had asked Jack and me and Dr. Packer to their home for Sunday dinner. Jack and I were to drive Dr. Packer there and back. However, when you have two professors together, they will likely talk shop. The night before, Saturday night, Jack got sick. He couldn't go on Sunday. So I had to drive Dr. Packer, and we talked. So here I am driving, and there's Dr. Packer. It's a British car, remember? I asked him about my seemingly unanswered prayer. What I was praying for, I knew was right, was good, would ease suffering, would bring glory to God. And yet God was not acting. Why? And Dr. Packer kindly said, God will bring about his glory in the long term. And then he leaned over and repeated, the long term. Okay, I said. But what I'm praying for would be right, would be holy. As long as God doesn't answer, sin is continuing. Dr. Packer looked at me and said very gently, everything we do involves sin. Everything we do involves sin. In five words, he had changed my perspective on what I was focusing on. Yes, I am to pray, and pray wisely, and then leave it with God. I cannot be responsible for another person's decisions, but I am responsible for me, my thoughts, attitudes, decisions, actions, and everything I think and do involves sin. I am in no position to be judging another person. About a year later, the suffering and sorrow got worse. The exact opposite of what I was praying for was coming about. That occurred during an unsettled year for us. Jack was on loan to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. I was continuing to come out here to Seattle regularly to care for my mom, and our home in St. Louis was being renovated. So here I was in desperate need of God's love and assurance, and outward life was anything but stable. Jack and I lived in an apartment in Chicago, but I frequently had to be in our house in St. Louis, and I also spent a lot of time here in Washington State, never in one place more than a few weeks at a time. I was living in three different cities, going to three different churches, talking with three different sets of friends. But God. Sunday by Sunday, I'd walk into whichever church, and I'd be met with the same truth. It was as if God was tapping the pastor on the shoulder, saying, Diane is going to be here this Sunday, and she needs to. It would be in the sermon, or in a hymn, or in a comment that a friend would make to me. I couldn't get away from it. God was pressing home the truth that I needed to trust him. He had always been good, faithful, loving, throughout history. And I wasn't going to find that he had suddenly changed and that his steadfast love had failed. He is the Lord. The Lord. A God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. The sorrow was still there. It was debilitating. I didn't know how to deal with it. I needed to know how to think, how to act, how to love. I needed strength to keep praying. During one of the many services I attended here during that time, we sang a William Cooper hymn that touched me deeply. It's hymn 128, God Moves in a Mysterious Way. It is based on Isaiah 42:16. During that trip out here, I was staying with Debbie and Howie Donahoe, so I told Debbie about the hymn and the verse. And a few weeks later, I received a package in Chicago at our apartment, which Debbie and Howie's daughter Annie had made for me. And it was a plaque with Isaiah 42:16 on it. And I will lead the blind in a way they do not know. In paths that they have not known, I will guide them. I will turn the darkness before them into light, the rough places into level ground. These are the things I do, and I do not forsake them. When J.R.R. Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings, he created a mythical world steeped in biblical truth. And God can use the words of our friend Tolkien to speak to us. Even if you don't know the story, you'll be able to catch on to the meaning here. The Fellowship of the Ring, those nine friends on a dangerous journey, have stopped for a time in Lothlorien, a place of great beauty and safety, a community of wise and powerful elves who protect and help them. On the night before the Fellowship of the Ring departs to continue their journey, the Queen of the Elves bids them good night. "Good night, my friends," said Galadriel. "Sleep in peace. Do not trouble your hearts overmuch with thought of the road tonight. Maybe the paths that you each shall tread are already laid before your feet, though you do not see them. Good night." If you think of that right next to that verse that Annie Donahoe put for me, the Isaiah 42, it's so similar. God knows our paths. He's making them for us. "I will turn the darkness before them into light, the rough places into level ground. These are things I do, and I do not forsake them." Again in The Lord of the Rings, at a particularly bleak point, the eight remaining friends are separated during a battle. One of the eight dies in battle. Frodo and Sam escape and take the ring on their original path. The enemy's forces carry off two of the hobbits as prisoners to almost certain torture and death. The three remaining friends have to decide quickly what to do, and they choose to pursue the prisoners to try to save them. After several days, they are unsuccessful. At this point, they are met by Gandalf, their old leader, who is transfigured in glory. He has been sent to serve and help them. Gandalf confirms to them that they cannot reach their abducted friends, but he does give them biblical guidance. Gandalf turned. "The quest of your companions is over." "Then are we not to see the merry young hobbits again?" said Legolas. "I did not say so," said Gandalf. "Who knows? Have patience. Go where you must go, and hope." Have patience. Go where you must go, and hope. It sounds simple. We are to trust God. We are to pray with patience. We are to do what we must do. And hope. 7 years ago, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, we had already RSVP'd for a friend's wedding at our church in St. Louis. The wedding took place during that time between diagnosis and surgery, when I was most anxious and most uncertain. The last thing I wanted to do was to attend a wedding and look happy. But we went. The bride was a musician. The service was beautifully crafted. But still, I was crying inside. At the end, the congregation sang together Beethoven's Ode to Joy, and the words so plainly show the majesty and goodness of the Lord that my inner crying turned to outward tears of joy. From the Lord, sorrow and love flowed mingled down.